From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for El Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. 47 Republican senators sent an open letter to Iran, warning its supreme leader that the next U.S. president could revoke any nuclear deal signed by the Obama administration unless Congress first approves it. Iraq reported major progress in an offensive to retake Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit, an operation in which Iran played a major role, but the United States did not. Israelis are preparing to vote in pivotal elections that could end the rule of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and usher in a center-left government less at odds with the United States over issues including Iran and Arab-Israeli peace talks. And finally, in the United States, presumptive presidential candidate Hillary Clinton held a news conference to answer questions about her use of a private email server when she was Secretary of State. Well, let's begin with the letter written by Tom Cotton and signed by 46 other Republican senators to the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. What were they thinking in telling a foreign leader that the President of the United States possibly didn't have the authority to sign an agreement on Iran's nuclear program?
Well, there's been a sort of three-pronged reaction here in Washington, and I think some of it has not been the reaction that history will remember. So there's been an initial, is this good for the Republicans, bad for the Republicans? And that I don't think is that interesting. There's also been a kind of fight about, was this somehow, illegal? Are they guilty of treason? Is this, within the Constitution? That as well is not that interesting. I think the really interesting question is, when these Republican senators wrote this open letter to Iran's leaders, were they really advancing America's national interest, which is what they claim to do? And I think that that's the real problem, is that they weren't advancing America's national interest. I mean, we need to be clear why they did this. They did this, in the words of Tom Cotton, the brand new senator who's been a senator for 2 months, who organized this effort, because he fundamentally doesn't believe that the negotiations taking place have any value, that they can lead to anything good. I think a very clarifying moment came when Tom Cotton, Senator Cotton of Arkansas, was being interviewed about the letter, and someone said, well, what do you make of the criticism from President Obama that by writing this letter, you have made common cause with the hardliners in Iran? And Tom Cotton's reply was, there are only hardliners in Iran.
Yeah.
So I think that was a very clarifying moment. What he was essentially saying is that the entire premise of these international talks, that there are more moderate figures, that Iran is capable of acting rationally, that you can increase the cost of an Iranian nuclear program to the point that Iran will choose a different path as a kind of rational act, he doesn't believe that. He essentially sides with people like Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, who came and told Congress at the invitation of Republicans a few days ago that essentially this is an apocalyptic death cult in charge of Iran, that they are not rational actors, and above all, that they are not trustworthy. And in essence, rather than trying to negotiate a solution to their desire to have an Iranian nuclear arsenal, you need to defeat them. You need to come up with coercion so massive that you can impose surrender on Iran, that you can impose terms in Iran. There is no point trying to negotiate terms with Iran. It has to be imposed, yeah. Otherwise it means nothing. And I think that Senator Cotton believes that. And everything he has said since is that he ignores criticism that says you're going to damage these negotiations. He says, good.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah.
This track of seeking a negotiated settlement, which involves Iran accepting a deal, is not worth going down, because any deal they could accept isn't worth having.
In fact, even earlier, he told the Heritage Foundation in January that the end of these negotiations isn't an unintended consequence of congressional action. It is very much an intended consequence. So he has said and made it clear from the beginning that he wants to blow up the negotiations. He doesn't want the negotiations to succeed. So it's not about a better deal. It's about no deal, as far as Tom Cotton is concerned. But I think there's another aspect, and you mentioned Benjamin Netanyahu, and that is the partisan nature of this opposition to the Iran negotiations. In the past, Congress has managed to make sanctions against Iran, policy on Iran, fairly bipartisan. There have always been Democrats who have supported these measures, sometimes in overwhelming numbers. But when you see this letter that's been signed by 47 Republicans only, in fact, it wasn't even shown to the Democrats. You do have partisanship very much entering the issue here. And a number of commentators, a number of editorialists in the United States have said this is very, very dangerous, not just for American foreign policy, but for American politics.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's also revealing. Let's not forget, 47 Republican senators signed this letter. Now, some of them, like Senator John McCain, former presidential candidate, sort of saying, well, maybe I didn't sort of really read it properly when
I signed it.
And signed it in a bit of a haste. Maybe it wasn't the most effective way of doing it. But here's an important detail. There were 7 Republican senators who didn't sign it. Now, some of those are essentially moderates from very centrist states, but there was an important person who didn't sign this. Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, very important man in Washington, the new chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate. He did not sign this letter. Now, he's not a squish on Iran. He's also not someone who particularly trusts President Obama to do a fantastic deal with Iran. He has expressed grave concerns that, in his view, President Obama is too willing to take any deal at any price. So he's absolutely a Republican on this. But why did Senator Corker, the chairman of the committee, not sign this letter? It's because he has a different approach to trying to achieve a good deal. His approach is to get a bipartisan, as you say, involving both Republicans and Democrats, to get a law passed which would require President Obama, after an initial deal is unveiled, to submit it to Congress and to suspend all of its kind of sanctions-lifting activity for 60 days and let Congress have a say. Now, that is a valuable exercise absolutely in the American constitutional tradition. The Congress would have a sort of review
and
oversight.
Except this is not a treaty.
It's not a treaty. But you can argue about the details. But I think the idea of Congress saying, you know, the president goes off with his administration and negotiates the deal, but then once the deal has been negotiated, instead of immediately putting all of its parts into action, let Congress have at least a say.
Let them
review it. That's not an unprecedented
act. I mean, the administration would argue that Congress will eventually have a say in terms of lifting sanctions. Also, there have been studies done and showing that over 90% of the international agreements the United States has entered into since 1939 have been done through executive action including some very important documents, such as the Shanghai Communique, the Helsinki Final Act. All of these were done through executive action.
That's right. But the politics, you know, the law is one thing. Clearly, can President Obama do this legally without Congress's say-so? Absolutely. Is it a stronger deal with a better chance of surviving a change of president or, political ructions here? Is it a stronger deal if Congress has had a say? Absolutely. Is Congress stronger when both parties are asking to have a say? Absolutely. And I think that's the reason that Senator Corker, the chairman of the committee, didn't sign this letter, because he wanted to go down the route of getting Democrats. And there are plenty of Democrats in the Senate who are very anxious about this deal. But now, as you say, it's become a Republican attack on the president.
Right.
Very hard for Democrats to get involved.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. Joining me today are Abdurrahim Fukar of Al Jazeera and David Rennie of The Economist. And now, this program announcement.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Abdurrahim, we're talking about the letter signed by 47 Republican senators, an open letter to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and the impact that it's had. I attended a news conference with the German foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, and asked him about the impact on the talks that have been going on with Iran. And he said it would undermine Western credibility and that it would give Iran more leverage in the negotiations. Do you think this letter will ultimately have that impact on the talks, or are the talks by now somehow insulated from the shenanigans in Washington?
I think they are and they are not. It's been obvious all along that President Obama has been worried about what message the Iranians would get even before the last congressional election if both houses are dominated by the Republicans. And we saw him go out of his way over the deal with Cuba. I think part of the reason why he came out so strongly in favor of the deal with Cuba was to reassure some of the adversaries outside the United States that although Congress is now dominated, both houses are dominated by the Republicans, the Iranians, for example, should not get the wrong message. He will be able to see a deal with them through. But having said that, when you look at the reaction of the Iranians, first of all, you had Khamenei himself basically trashing the letter of the Republican senators.
He said we couldn't be trusted, but he said that before, of course.
He said that before. But what I found most interesting, more interesting than Khamenei's reaction, was the reaction of the foreign minister of Iran.
Javad Zarif, yeah.
Basically lecturing Republicans about the vagaries of the American system, political system, but also reminding them that this is not just a deal with the U.S. and Iran. This involves also other partners, Western right. powers, who are allies of the United States in over this issue of Iran's nuclear program.
Yeah, I think the concern, if talks do not result in an agreement, there will be a blame game, David, and the Iranians will be able to point to these activities by the U.S. Congress and say, well, it's not our fault. It's because we have severe doubts about whether the United States will be able to implement mm-hmm. an agreement because of Congress. So the question is, do you want to hand that kind of argument to the Iranians?
No, absolutely. But of course, what you're dealing with is this sort of nihilist position on the Republican side that whatever Iran says is irrelevant, and probably for a lot of them, a kind of unilateralist feeling that there is no value to an international coalition with Russians and Chinese and Europeans in it. How can you have faith in that? That itself is nothing worth having. That the only way that this will end is with America and Israel coercing Iran to give up its bomb at the kind of the point of a threat
yeah,
so severe.
Of course, how do you coerce without sanctions that are multilateral?
But I think if you look at the text of the letter, which was a remarkably kind of rude letter, it sort of begins, you know, it has come to our attention, or we have reason to believe that you don't understand our constitutional system while we're observing the nuclear negotiations that you are holding with our government,
right.
completely ignoring the assistance of the other countries. Because I think in the Republican worldview, this is all part of a kind of narrative at the moment that President Obama is kind of Jimmy Carter, but kind of worse, that this is a weak and feckless president who is not only a naive negotiator, but is also doesn't love America enough and doesn't believe in American exceptionalism, and therefore is willing to sell America short and to suck up to America's enemies and to leave America's allies in the ditch. And that is this incredibly powerful narrative on the Republican side, that this is an illegitimate foreign policy
right.
president.
Right. Well, we will soon see, Abdurrahim, whether these talks will come to fruition. But I want to turn now to another issue that also actually involves both the United States and Iran, and that's the fighting that's been going on into Crete. It looks like Iraqi forces are succeeding, but apparently two-thirds of the forces that are expelling the Islamic State from Tikrit are Shia militias, who, as we know, have been strongly backed by Iran, as is the Baghdad government. And the United States is not, as far as we know, involved in this, what could be a warm-up for going into Mosul.
Well, evidently with adversity comes also opportunity. I mean, this whole situation with ISIL, ISIS, the Islamic State, in Iraq, what it's done to Iraq and the Iraqis has played in Iran's favor, not just in terms of actually consolidating its influence in Iraq, but in terms of being perceived as being on the same side of the fight as the great Satan, as the Iranians once called the United States. So it's an incredible turnaround of events. Whether the militias will ultimately succeed in doing the job of defeating ISIS obviously remains to be seen. You mentioned the fight around and in Tikrit. The Iraqi army says that they have achieved some progress outside of Tikrit. The fighting continues to be fierce over the heart of Tikrit. How important is Tikrit to ISIS? We saw what they did in Kobani, and the fight was fierce and prolonged. It was said at the time that the fight of Kobani was so crucial to the future of ISIS in Iraq. Now we're hearing the same thing about Tikrit, except that this time there has been significant progress, especially if you see it from the Iraqi, Iranian and the U.S. side against ISIS. There is now some visibility as to where this is all going. Whether you can, the U.S. and its allies, including Iran now and the militias, will actually get there or how long it takes them, that's obviously not a done deal yet.
Yeah. David, obviously, if Tikrit falls from the ISIS perspective, this is a blow to their pretensions of invincibility. We're already seeing that some Iraqi Sunni groups are now joining in with the government because they perhaps sense that that Tikrit will go back into government hands. How important a victory do you think this would be? And what about this kind of awkward dance that's being done by the United States and Iran, both supporting the Iraqi government against the Islamic State, but allegedly not coordinating with each other?
Well, I think from the American perspective, you've got a very odd sort of conversation going on here in Washington. You see those Americans who are paid to understand what's happening on the ground, people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the top military officer, expressing publicly, as you say, concerns that, some of the wrong people are helping in this fight. Well, I mean, that's America discovering that if you're not prepared to put your own people into the fight, you don't get to choose who does join the fight. I mean, this is the strategy, is to let locals sort out these problems. And guess what? You know, they decide who turns up. The odd thing is, if you look at the political debates, if you look at Capitol Hill and Congress, they're not even grappling with this. You know, their narrative is that there's a very bad and dangerous Iran and a very bad and dangerous Islamic State. And there's very little acknowledgement that actually at the moment they're fighting each other. The real story is about how President Obama is such a bad president that he's incapable of defeating ISIS and he's incapable of stopping Iran getting a bomb. And this is because he's unwilling. I mean, we're playing sort of linguistic games here. You know, people spend their entire time, if you listen to Republican politicians who want to be the next president, their main thing they say about Islamic State at the moment, and I've spent days and days listening to them recently, is the problem is that President Obama is not willing to say that they're Muslims. And until he's willing to be brave enough to say that they are Islamic, then we're never going to defeat them. So we are in such a kind of navel-gazing, kind of word game, kind of argument about rhetoric, as if somehow the power of words sort of magically will make this problem go away. There is no grown-up debate here about whether America is on the spot as Iran helps the Iraqi government take to grip. There should be that debate. As you say, you can see people at the top of the Pentagon having qualms about this. But in terms of the politics of this, there's no debate.
Yeah. Can I add this?
Sure, if you can wait one moment.
I think in the perception of public opinion, a war that does not involve ground troops is almost an amorphous war. For Americans, because the United States does not allegedly have boots on the ground in Iraq, following this war is really a tricky issue. Yes, you hear about it all the time and you hear about ISIS and so on, but it's hard to actually grapple with and fathom. ISIS becomes something much more tangible when both Republicans and Democrats talk about ISIS, the threat of ISIS here in the United States in terms of ISIS being able to recruit within U.S. society.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of Al Monitor. Joining me today are David Rennie of The Economist and Abdurrahim Fukar of Al Jazeera. And now this.
Here's a quick quiz. What do the letters LTATOMLAW stand for? We know the answer, right? Listen to Akwe Thompson on Nightline Africa Weekends. Add to that 16 and 18 UTC on VOA, and we have a perfect score. That was easy.
Welcome back. Let's turn quickly, David, to the Israeli elections, which are coming up. These could be really momentous elections if Benjamin Netanyahu does not get enough votes, if Likud does not get enough votes to form a new government.
All Israeli elections are momentous. It's the democracy in the region. It's a big player. But these ones have unusual international sort of significance because we had, apart from anything else, we had one of the big election rallies effectively of this election took place in the U.S. House of Representatives because Benjamin Netanyahu came to give a speech at the Republicans' invitation, which was essentially an Israeli campaign rally in which he was saying, I will take on this bad American president and, you know, tell him what to do in Washington. That was a bet by Benjamin Netanyahu that in order to rally the right-wing vote in Israel, it was in his interests to pick a public fight with the American president. We haven't seen that in the past. It was always previously dangerous to fall out too much with an American president. What's interesting, if you believe, I was just looking at the reporting from our correspondents in Israel writing about the election, it doesn't seem to have really hurt him. If he is falling behind in some polls now and there's a surge from the center-left coalition, that's often about economic issues, a sense that he's talking so much about Iran and nukes and issues of war that he's forgotten that people are struggling to make their mortgage payments. They're worried about jobs. And so there doesn't seem to be a big backlash in Israel for his sort of international, certainly his assault on President Obama doesn't seem to have hurt him in Israeli politics.
Abdurim, I'm not so sure. I mean, he expected a bump from the address to the joint session of Congress, and he certainly hasn't gotten that. The polls have shown, in fact, that Likud is losing support. But there's another interesting story which is emerging. According to the polls, the center-left coalition is first and followed by Likud. But in the third spot is a joint list of Arab parties. Mm-hmm. All the various Arab parties have now joined together. And I don't think we've ever seen this before in Israel. What would it imply if the Arab list gets 14 or 15 seats in the Knesset?
Well, indeed, this is unprecedented. Although Arab Israelis are just as divided as the rest of Israelis in this particular election. But you're right, this whole debate about a united front among Arab Israelis to represent the 1.5 million Palestinians living in Israel is something new. But, you know, conventional wisdom is that the more unified you are, the more consolidated your position is within the Knesset. That's the conventional wisdom. It doesn't always work out like that in practice.
Could this, I mean, if center-left forms the government, this Arab group could actually wind up supporting it and giving it cover to make some changes in Israeli policy, perhaps on settlements, on the peace process, and that could be quite something. But we are quickly running out of time, and David, I wanted to give you a moment to talk about Hillary Clinton and her press conference. I was reminded of the comment that Barack Obama made during the 2008 campaign where he said she was likable enough. Was she likable enough? Was she persuadable enough? Do you think this issue of her emails is going to go away? Is it going to stay with us?
I don't think she's making new friends with this. I think there are quite a lot of Democrats who understand they don't have any alternative candidate of any stature at all. And so they're either saying this is just a Republican beat-up and we're going to sort of circle the wagons and defend her, or they're just going, oh, my goodness, she's at it again. The Clintons are just very secretive, very high-handed people who think they're above the rules, but we haven't got a choice, so we're going to stick with her. But she didn't make any new friends or new admirers this week, and they have a problem, which is that she isn't a fantastic candidate. The idea of Hillary Clinton is often more exciting than the reality of Hillary Clinton.
Abdurim, there was a column by a Washington Post columnist, Charles Krautheimer, that was talking about early Clinton fatigue syndrome. Are we already getting tired of her and she hasn't yet declared?
Well, Charles Krauthammer is the kind of thing that you would expect him to say, being who he is. Look, the Clintons, as we all know, they are capable of incredible comebacks. And we've seen this from Bill, we've seen it from Hillary. And I wouldn't put it past her to leap back again to the forefront, although this business of the emails has at least temporarily hurt her.
All right. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
from Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador Mark Lagon. He's president of Freedom House, the first human rights organization ever established in the United States. And we're coming to you from Freedom House headquarters in Washington, D.C. Founded in 1941, with the support of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, Freedom House has a legacy of defending democracy, press liberties, and basic human dignity around the globe. Prior to taking the helm at Freedom House, Mark Lagon was Chair for Global Politics and Security at Georgetown University and Senior Fellow for Human Rights at the Council on Foreign Relations. Previously, he was Executive Director of the leading anti-human trafficking nonprofit, Polaris. He earlier served at the State Department as U.S. Ambassador at Large, directing the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons from 2007 to 2008. He also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs. Mark Lagon is the co-editor of the recently published book, Human Dignity and the Future of Global Institutions. And Mark Lagon is no stranger to the VOA microphones. He was a regular panelist on our U.S. Foreign Policy Look Ahead show recorded at Georgetown University. Well, we'll be talking with Mark about Freedom House's 2015 Freedom in the World report, which talks about a waning of liberty around the world and an explosion of terrorist violence. Well, Mark Lagon, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you, as always.
Thanks for hosting us here at Freedom House. Well, Mark, first I want to congratulate you on a map, Freedom in the World 2015, in which you actually place Cape Verde on the map, a little small archipelago off the coast of West Africa, which most maps somehow don't deem worthy of placing on the map. But at any rate, I want to first congratulate you on that. And of course, it rates a free status, which is very, very good. Based on the Freedom in the World 2015 report, looks like 2014 saw an overall decline in political rights and civil liberties around the world. Your report concludes that democratic ideals are under the greatest threat in 25 years, and you ranked Syria at the bottom and cited violence in Ukraine. Talk a little bit about some of the highlights and obviously the lowlights, in a sense, of this report.
Well, our report has gradations of the degree to which countries are free, that they respect human rights, whether they have democracy in full, but even beyond elections, having pluralism. And we found that there's been backtracking on overall freedom in the world for 9 consecutive years. For 9 consecutive years, more countries have had a decline in their human rights than have had an improvement. So this year, for instance, there were 63 countries that had a decrease in human rights, whereas 33 went up. The big trends are a more brazen, old-fashioned, coercive form of repression, not just the subtleties of false democracy and bogus elections, but actually, you know, brutal repression of expression and dissent, and then terrorism as a source of a human rights abuse. We need to remember that not only should we be worried that counterterrorism not harm human rights, but in a very fundamental way, whether it's Boko Haram or ISIS, that terrorists are violating the most fundamental of human rights, including life.
Let's dig down deeper into these major trends. You talk about, you know, brutal tactics, overt, brazen violation of human rights. For some reason,
Russia comes to my mind with respect to...
For good reason.
Yes. With respect to the illegal annexation of Crimea, its destabilization of Ukraine. Talk about some specific countries.
Well, you're right to raise Russia not only for its violation of sovereignty in Ukraine, and we're just about to put out a report with the Atlantic Council on how in Crimea human rights have been harmed markedly since that annexation, but at home in Russia... The treatment of journalists, treatment of those who are lesbian and gay, represents pretty straightforward, direct rejection of democratic standards. Egypt, as General al-Sisi took power, has moved Egypt in a direction that would probably be best seen as more authoritarian and more restricted than even under Hosni Mubarak. Turkey, President Erdogan has taken things in the direction of squeezing independent media and ignoring the independent judiciary's role whatsoever. And of course, China has had a strong economic growth model, but without political and civil expression. Xi Jinping, as a leader, has been bent upon more centralization of personal power than anyone since Deng Xiaoping.
Mark Legon, why do you think this trend toward greater repression of the press and human rights is taking place?
Well, the question I ask myself is, how concerned or depressed should we be if you are hoping for the spread of freedom in the world? Is a more brazen form of authoritarian repression a sign of cockiness, of confidence on the part of autocratic leaders, or is it a white-knuckled grip that they're hanging on to power and that subtle forms of propaganda or bogus elections aren't working? I actually remain quite optimistic that despite this backward trend over the last 9 years, that there still hasn't been a massive backward wave in that democratization wave that was launched with the end of the Cold War, and that in fact civil society will be more innovative and demand change in ways that will be much more vital in the medium term and the long term than the ability of autocrats to hang on to power.
And certainly your organization, Freedom House, does a lot to inspire and probably give courage to these civil society groups. So let's go back and talk specifically about what Freedom House does specifically, the reports it issues, and your vision for the next years or while you're at the helm, what you're looking to emphasize specifically.
Well, Freedom House is famous for its reports. Those are the flagship. Not only the Freedom in the World report, but global reports on freedom of the press and freedom on the net. But in fact, the majority of what we do, the majority of the woman and man hours of our staff around the world are on helping civil society partners fight their own fight around the world for those rights that are often on paper but not realized by people. So whether it be in Kenya assisting people to assert their rights so that a minority group is not marginalized, or whether it is assisting women in the Middle East in a place like Jordan to assert their rights, we are there not taking on this fight as ours, but helping those who are citizens of their own societies demand of their governments change.
Do you have offices in other parts of the world?
We do. Just some of the places that we have offices include Mexico City, Caracas, Venezuela, Vilnius, Lithuania, where I'm going to be visiting just in a few days, where we, you know, assist others from the region who are trying to bring about political change. We have offices in Jordan, South Africa. Just this morning, I was on the phone with our team in Mali.
And Mark, as president, of course, you can set the agenda to some extent in addition to the core work you do. Do you have a particular focus that you want to emphasize?
Well, I think that there are some traditions that I really want to carry on, and I want to make sure that we don't change. Holding up a hot white spotlight on the record of human rights of countries around the world, which is how we get the Freedom in the World report and a map that categorizes countries as free, partly free, and not free. I want to take that farther. We have a lot of information about trend lines since the 1970s about elements of political and civil liberties, and I'd like those to be even more accessible to the global public as an asset. As far as work on the ground, we need to work on some particularly important issues. Two I'd mention are freedom of expression, whether it be on the internet, journalists who are subject to violent intimidation or other forms of freedom of expression. That's a real niche for us, something we do well. And we, in fact, have increasingly been involved in emergency assistance to human rights defenders who are under pressure. The other thing I'm really eager to do is to take very good work that we do on female empowerment, on gender equality, and scale it up. I believe that when the majority of people, which women are in the world, are marginalized, be from property rights or political voice, that that is a calamitous situation and a waste of a big asset for prosperity and freedom in the world.
You wrote an opinion editorial recently in the Wall Street Journal in which you discussed how autocratic regimes exploit terrorism as a pretext for repression. So I want to talk about that.
Good.
You know, leaders in authoritarian or totalitarian regimes like Russia, China, Venezuela, or Syria, how they either silence, imprison, or worse, murder dissidents by falsely claiming these dissidents are terrorists. And you also mentioned that in some places, place these so-called terrorists in psychiatric wards, for example. I mean, basically trying to undermine and disguise, you know, the true nature, of what they're doing. How can and should the free world democracies respond to these cynical tactics?
I'm very glad you asked. A finding of our report is that terrorists cause human rights abuses, brutal ones. Remember, what's the definition of a terrorist? Someone who purposefully targets innocent civilians for harm. But dictatorships around the world, whether they be a number of so-called allies of the United States in the Middle East, or the Chinese, or the Russians, use the excuse of real terrorism existing to brand their enemies terrorists, whether it be the Maduro government in Venezuela that treats opposition like they're terrorists, or the Chinese. I'm really taken with the case of the Chinese targeting the Uyghur people, the Muslims of what China calls Xinjiang, East Turkestan. Not only are they using terrorism as an excuse for treating every person in Xinjiang as if they are violent extremists, but they are in fact repressing religious freedom, the ability of Muslims to practice their religion in the name of counterterrorism.
And again, does Freedom House recommend ways in which we can combat these tendencies, whether as individuals or countries, governments?
Well, it does help if the United States' own record of counterterrorism does not have blemishes. It's good if the U.S. policy on detainees or drones, you know, does not call into question the tactics of counterterrorism. That said, we in the NGO community need to point to those times that autocrats are putting forward a bogus argument that their political enemies are somehow terrorists.
Of course, so what comes to mind is Syria. You know, we have a regime that brands its opposition as terrorists. And I know that in the most recent report, you say that Syria has really gone downhill, is one of the worst rated countries in terms of freedom.
Well, atrocities have occurred in Syria, and the record of Assad is appalling. And any discussion of atrocities prevention by the civilized world is laughable in thinking about how little has been done to prevent atrocities in Syria. Unfortunately, nonviolent opposition to Assad has been overtaken and eclipsed by violent extremists, including ISIS. And freedom in the world looks society by society about where freedom is increasing and decreasing. And sometimes it's the government that's the source of the harm, and sometimes it's paramilitaries and terrorists. In the case of Syria, the public, the innocents of Syrian society are being squeezed from both sides.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador Mark Lagon. He's president of Freedom House, the oldest human rights organization in America. Mark is the co-editor of the recently published book, Human Dignity and the Future of Global Institutions. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, and we are coming to you from Freedom House headquarters in downtown Washington. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can send feedback via email to pcusa@voanews.com. Either way, tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to a very faithful listener from Turkey, Ida Ipek. Teşekkürler. Well, back to you, Mark Lagon. Let's pursue our conversation. And are there any bright spots in the world?
There are. And I think it's very important for us when we look at an overall trend of decline in freedom and be troubled by Egypt, Russia, China, Venezuela, and other places that we look at those bright spots. Tunisia is the most striking bright spot found in the report. So our report has subtle levels of ratings from 1 to 7 on political rights and civil liberties. But we categorize countries as free, partly free, and not free. The only country in the Arab Middle East in the last 40 years that has been categorized as fully free has arisen this year in Tunisia. It had a progressive constitution put in place in January of 2014 and successively had good, clean, fair parliamentary and presidential elections. And as some people have been distraught that the so-called Arab Spring has not led to democratization or the spread of freedom on a steady path, the world community should focus on helping Tunisia be a success story.
Indeed. Of course, in contrast, we have countries like you mentioned earlier, Egypt, which has resorted to another tactic, police brutality, sham trials, severe prison sentences, and so forth, which, of course, is very disconcerting.
It is. You know, we've had 3 phases of trouble where under Mubarak, he presented the United States and the West with a false choice. You either back me and bankroll me massively, or you'll get the Muslim Brotherhood, preventing there being other moderate choices between those two. The Muslim Brotherhood, once they took power under Morsi, restricted any independent judiciary. And as a colleague of mine said, the Arab Spring meant a winter for women and women's rights. And now al-Sisi has taken things in a much more brazen and brutal way in terms of a grip on dissent.
Well, I guess just documenting that is an important step toward hopefully correcting it at some point.
And, you know, documentation is important. One thing we try and do is help local civil society organizations document human rights abuses. When the time comes of a transition for people to be held to account, to have that documented evidence so that there can be transitional justice can lay the groundwork for reconciliation and more durable democracy later.
Is there a website or a place where perhaps some of our listeners could turn to if they wanted more information about Freedom House and how it can help them?
Good. We'd welcome you to look up freedomhouse.org, Freedom House, all one word, .org. And there you'll find our reports, some texture of our programmatic work around the world.
Well, of course, you mentioned corruption, and we note that there is certainly a relationship between lack of freedom and the lack of human rights and corruption. There's also a relationship between the spike in terrorism and countries with widespread corruption, inept governance, and weak or non-existent democratic institutions. So to fight terrorism isn't the long-term answer to tackle the root problem of inept governance, lack of democratic institutions. But at the same time, here we are in the United States and in the West in general, is sometimes either complicit with some of the regimes that are very corrupt or undemocratic. So what comes to mind, of course, is Nigeria, its security forces vis-a-vis Boko Haram.
Yeah.
I'm not blaming the Nigerian government necessarily, but many say that the government has exacerbated the problem by either heavy-handed tactics or corruption in the military, so the security forces aren't fighting as effectively as they could. There's lack of economic development in the north, which may have attracted some people to Boko Haram. And then, of course, we have the same thing vis-a-vis Syria, where presumably if the West perhaps had helped the peaceful, nonviolent opposition earlier on, or the army defectors, the proliferation of the jihadis backed now or backed previously at least by Saudi Arabia or Qatar may not have materialized. You also mentioned in one of your articles, I believe, the Shiite-led government in Iraq marginalized the Sunni tribes, and now a lot of them see the Shia militias and the Shia-led government perhaps as threatening as the so-called Islamic State. So how do we deal with these very deep problems that we help to create to some extent?
If you ask what the purpose and approach of Freedom House is, it is to focus on there being more democratic nations in the world, and not just elections, but accountable, trustworthy governments that produce for their people and treat everybody like they're a citizen in full. that's not just a matter of universal values and idealism. It's actually something that is very practical. Those are going to be stable states. Those are going to be states more likely to be prosperous, to deliver for people. We are very focused on those countries that are democracies in the world, whether they be in the West or whether they be rising democracies of the global South, like Brazil and India, stepping up and holding nations to account. If the democracies of the world are complicit in allowing countries to be autocratic, brutal in putting down opposition, or corrupt, it's a breeding ground for terrorism. And we're not doing anybody any favors by treating such countries as allies that should not be chided.
And then, of course, there's Russia. It seems like Vladimir Putin didn't get the memo that the Cold War is over. He, of course, invaded and annexed Crimea. We witnessed the recent assassination of opposition leader and Putin critic Boris Nemtsov, the constant destabilization of Ukraine, whereby Putin's Russia cynically denies involvement and blames either the West or the United States or the opposition, you know, for creating the very conditions that actually the Kremlin is most likely responsible for. He uses state-controlled media to broadcast propaganda, false narratives. Again, this points to democracies, Mark Legon. Why aren't democracies doing more to fight, for example, the propaganda war by Vladimir Putin to counter the narrative and not just condemn the invasion of Crimea or lament, you know, the murder of Boris Nemtsov, but actually, you know, put more money in action, you know, where their indignation is?
Well, you put your finger on a serious problem. Vladimir Putin, rather than responding to the West, has been the provocative actor. Some people say that a country like Ukraine talking to the EU and NATO about associating with them is provocative. What's provocative has been the actions of Putin to hold up his power, and when the economy of Russia has slid, to build up, to whip up support with nationalist goals. There is a very concerted, expensive effort by Putin to have a media campaign. And, you know, the West needs to think about countering that campaign. I'm about to visit Lithuania in a few days, and they're very concerned about their whole region being suffused with Russian state media. And this was a big problem in Ukraine. The whole narrative, bald lies about desires of Russian ethnic populations being unanimous in wanting to split off from Ukraine, was shaped by propaganda. We need to respond, and honestly, we need to not only rely on private sector media, but some things like public sector broadcasting.
And indeed, and I assume that that would be a much more cost-effective way to combat this type of provocation.
I'm a huge believer in bargains for foreign policy. You know, going to war and using the expensive tools of military violence are necessary, but they shouldn't be the first option. And programs to assist civil society organizations that are trying to push for more freedom, human rights, and democracy, those are a bargain. And broadcasting and public diplomacy programs that through exchanges or broadcasts or internet platforms make people have choices of objective information, these are bargains that can make for a freer world and a more stable one, and to grapple with Putin.
Correct. And perhaps, Mark Legon, you need to go up to Capitol Hill and talk to some of our members of Congress. At any rate, let me turn now.
I plan to be.
Okay. Let me turn now to an interesting proposal by Amnesty International. It has recently called on the UN Security Council, its five members, to give up their power of veto in cases where mass atrocities are being committed. Does Freedom House endorse this proposal? And what might be the chances of it even, you know, getting passed? What are the obstacles?
Well, I would modify the proposal of Amnesty International. I think that the permanent five members of the Council, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China, should voluntarily not use their veto when a case of atrocities is going on. Russia has used its veto to prevent action on Syria. There are a number of cases where permanent five members have stood in the way. They should voluntarily set that aside. you know, that we have to fight over things, you know, and scratch away at the will of the Security Council is sad. But I will say, you know, there's more of a sense in the Security Council that humanitarian intervention is reasonable than there was several years ago. And if you just look at the Commission of Inquiry of the UN about atrocities that have been committed in North Korea, well, unsurprisingly, China and Russia blocked action on that. However, they allowed an agenda item on human rights in North Korea to be added to the Security Council's array of issues that it deals with. So, slow progress.
Well, speaking of North Korea, will nothing short of a major regime change unleash greater freedom or freedom, period, in that most reclusive and rogue regime?
Well, regime change has gotten a dirty name because it's associated with military intervention. And the United States, the West, the world community should not look to turn first or often to invasion to bring about change. But let's be clear. This is one of the most sadistic, harmful governments in the world. It needs to change. Hopefully North Koreans will bring about that change.
And finally, Mark Lagon, despite all the bad news that your organization documented in 2014, the rise in terrorism and dictatorship, you say that freedom's adversaries do not represent the wave of the future. What makes you so sure, and what can we all do collectively to make sure that, in fact, is the case?
We should get off the psychiatrist's couch. Those people who think that the dictatorships of the world have taken the playbook and the plan of civil society and social media and then reverse engineered it and taken cues to control civil society and social media, that's not going to last. The creativity, the will to be free, the desire for dignity, for everybody to be treated worthy of access to justice, that is going to overwhelm dictators, even those that seem to be the most entrenched, from China to Saudi Arabia.
Ambassador Mark Lagon is president of Freedom House. That's the first and longest standing human rights organization in the United States. Mark, thank you so much for your time and your terrific insights.
It's always a special pleasure to be on VOA.
And we wish you the best here at Freedom House. Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Ted Schneider. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, The Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to The Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.